nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Okay, so today let's start talking about a new module. It's on low power design. Of course, power consumption these days is very important in virtually any electronic system or integrated circuit that you design, you know, ranging from extremely power constrained medical implants or sensors on the one hand, where battery life on very small cost, very small size, very small weight batteries needs to be in the order of several years. To, on the other hand, other end of the computing spectrum, you have large supercomputers which and data centers which have come under the scanner more recently in terms of their impact, in terms of the environmental burden that they place, right? So, you know, all ends of the electronic system spectrum, power is a concern today. So this is a very important topic. Different people have different reasons as to why they feel power consumption is important. You know, here are my top five reasons. Number one, how many Hoover dams does it take? And I'll explain what I mean. The second is the true cost. And here when I say cost, I mean purely economic cost as opposed to, you know, societal impact, environmental impact and so on. But purely if you try to quantify it economically, what is the cost of power? The third is the desire, our desire as users to be able to do more computing anytime, anywhere for less power consumption or, you know, more battery life. And the fourth is more of a technology-driven factor, which is the end of, we all talk about the end of scaling, but the end of classical scaling, which actually has already happened some time back. And finally, you know, the impact of power as designers on correct operation of ICs and therefore the increase in design complexity that we as designers need to go through as a consequence of power consumed by the chips, the additional design complexity that is added to make sure that chips work correctly. So, you know, these are five reasons. I'm sure you could come up with others, but, you know, hopefully we all agree that power consumption is important. And let's quickly breeze through these reasons and then go on to the topic of this lecture, which is at the logic level, how can design automation help in terms of both analyzing your circuits for how much power they're going to consume and also reducing the power consumption in circuits. Okay. First, how many Hoover dams? Anybody recognize this picture? Of course, I've given the name. You know what the Hoover Dam is? It's a large hydroelectric power project built in the 1930s, actually during the Great Depression, between 1931 and 36, on the Colorado River, right? It's in between the states of Arizona and Colorado. And at the time it was constructed, or a few years thereafter, it was the largest hydroelectric power project in the world, right? So, you know, it was something that was really supposed to address a significant fraction of the energy demands of the United States at the time it was constructed. So, you know, the Hoover Dam is sort of a representative of these large mega-scale power projects. These days, if you look at how much energy goes into powering electronic systems or computers or, you know, even if you now look at just personal computers or just data centers or just mobile phones, even specific classes of electronic computing systems, it's multiple Hoover dams. Okay. And while, you know, the numbers are, math is relatively straightforward, when you sit back and think about it, it's rather daunting to think about how many Hoover dams are currently in operation just to power the processors that go into computers, for example. Okay. We'll get back to that point, but a few more pictures. Any idea about what this is? It's the ENIAC, the first fully Turing-complete electronic computer, built in 1946. Had at the time a very, very impressive speed of 5,000 additions per second. It required a small apartment, about 1,800 square feet, to house it. Weighed about 30 tons. Consumed about 175,000 watts of power. Okay. So good amount of power consumption. And for reference, you know, a kilowatt is roughly the power consumption of an average US home. Okay. It's about 175 homes, equivalent in terms of power consumption. Now, well, this is not quite now, but this is recent past. I use this example because this is something that, you know, I was partially involved with. I used to work for a company called NEC before I came to Purdue. And in they built this supercomputer known as the Earth Simulator. The primary, as the name suggests, the primary intent was for climate simulation research in Japan. This was installed in Japan. It was at the time, in fact, between 2002 and 2004, it actually had the title of the world's fastest supercomputer. I mean, it's been far exceeded now, but the concepts I talk about certainly still apply even to more current supercomputers. Built 2002, speed of about 35 teraflops. These days you're talking about, you know, a single workstation or a single server, a single box, giving you about a teraflop or a few teraflops. So, you know, of course, these days supercomputers are in order of, you know, you've gone to petaflops, and then people are talking about exascale computing as the next challenge for the next 5 to 10 years. Okay, so it's, you know, multiple, or, you know, orders of magnitude have certainly passed, but at the time this was very impressive. It required a space of 35,000 square feet. Okay, certainly a big, nice little upgrade over the ENIAC, but also requires more space, and in terms of power consumption, 13 million watts. In fact, this is actually a picture of the Earth Simulator building. You know, the users, all the researchers, this was a climate simulation research institute in Japan. All the users that were using it, all the researchers were actually sitting in this building, and the computer itself required this building, primarily because of the cooling requirements, you know, the computer and the Earth Simulator itself. It required a separate cooling plant in order to be able to drive, to cool such all the power, the heat produced, and all of that power is consumed. And as you'd imagine, it required a separate, a small electric substation to be able to supply all the power consumption that's needed. Okay. So when you're talking of a supercomputer these days, or a data center for that matter, that powers, you know, Google or any of these web services that we are so accustomed to using, take for granted in our day-to-day lives, behind the scenes, this is what is going on. Okay. On the other hand, I don't, you know, mean to suggest that all designs or all computing platforms are power inefficient. Certainly when you really require very high performance, you know, there is some inefficiency that you will have to incur in terms of power consumption. On the other extreme, other end of the spectrum, if you look at mobile phones, not quite the other end of the spectrum, but closer to the other end of the spectrum. Again, this is a design that I was personally involved with. This was the world's first multi-core mobile phone processor. It had, as you can see, two ARM processor cores and some other processors. So they actually had a total of 5 programmable processors. I was responsible for leading a team that designed a security processor, which is one of the fifth programmable processor not shown here in the picture. But this was built in 2004, and this could execute about a gigaop per second. Okay. Size, you know, of course, a square centimeter. Power consumed, 0.25 watts. So yes, certainly, you know, about 3-4 orders of magnitude lower performance, but many, many more orders of magnitude lower power, right? So these days, in fact, there's a lot of interest at, you know, thinking about technology. Conventionally, this is a good example of what you can do, compute how efficient computing can be from an energy perspective if you really design for energy, you care about energy. These days, you know, it's come around full circle. There's a lot of interest in building supercomputers using such mobile cores or mobile processors. In fact, Barcelona Supercomputing Center, one of the leading high-performance computing facilities in Europe, is actually currently in the process of using NVIDIA's Tegra. NVIDIA's Tegra is one of the mobile application processor chips, similar to, you know, this product from NEC. You know, it's a more recent one. And they're currently, the Barcelona Supercomputing Center is building a supercomputer that they project will be close to the fastest in the world. May not be the fastest in the world, but it will certainly be the most energy efficient when it's completed. That's the projection, by using mobile processors, using Tegra chips specifically, right? So there's a lot of interest based on the huge environmental impact of data centers and supercomputers, and trying to see how you can address them, and certainly some interesting directions going on. But getting back on message a little bit, what is the societal impact of computing? If you just look at CPUs, okay, you can say that we as IC designers cannot impact the entire box. You can just impact the chips in the box. Well, one of the chips in the box, the CPU. If you look at the total power consumption of CPUs in all computers in the world, personal computers, in 2001, it was about 9 billion watts, and that's about 4 Hoover dams. Okay, so 4 Hoover dams had to be operating just to power the processors inside the world's computers. In 2005, it was about 20 Hoover dams. And of course, that has, you know, been increasing ever since, which has caused a lot of concern. There's an organization called Greenpeace, which actually monitors and tries to get involved in trying to shape public perception and opinion about energy use in computing platforms. And they have some interesting studies. There was one even recently released about how clean data centers are in terms of their energy usage. But if you look at just servers and the associated infrastructure, which is probably the fastest growing segment, the worldwide energy usage was about 123 billion kilowatt hours. And by 2010, it had exceeded 250 billion kilowatt hours. To give you, put this in perspective, the fluorescent lighting used everywhere all around the world. You know, we all talk about fluorescent, lighting being so, a big energy hog and use more energy efficient lamps and so on. Worldwide lighting was only in 2010 was only about 200 billion kilowatt hours, right? In 2010, data centers used about 1.3% of worldwide electricity. And this is between 05 and 10, this is growing at about 35% per year. So, you know, it's not just, you can say 1.3% is not a big deal, but, you know, if you project the rate of growth, one can really envision a scenario where a good chunk of the world's energy production is just going into powering data centers, all forms of computing, all forms of electronics. So there's a big societal impact that people are increasingly concerned about. And some of you may be aware, April 22nd was actually, which was a couple of days back, was actually Earth Day. The government, the U.S. government has formed new research agencies just to look at this problem. Well, not just about the energy consumption of computing, but to solve energy at a broader scale. But a good part of ARPA-E's focus is actually looking at computing. And for an interesting opinion on how the demand for energy is actually going to drive society and the world dynamics going forward, the book by Thomas Friedman, Hot, Flat, and Crowded, is a pretty interesting read. So I'd recommend that one. But green is truly in. Right, green, you know, it's really more and more important to be green these days. Consumers are demanding it. We as, you know, members of society are demanding it. Now, that is, of course, if that itself is not enough reason to be power conscious in computing or designing integrated circuits, let's consider just the economic cost of power. Right? So if you think of how power impacts your design in dollars and cents, there is three different ways. There's the product cost, which is the cost of actually generating the product, putting it together, manufacturing the product. There is the operation cost, which is the cost of operating the product. And if, you know, for example, if it's a computer, you as a user will be paying some amount of money to the electricity utility company in order to be operating your computer. And then there's the replacement cost. So the product cost hits you in terms of the packaging and cooling that you need to put around these integrated circuits or chips in order to keep them operating at a reasonable temperature, to keep them cool. Because power consumption gets dissipated as heat, and you cannot allow integrated circuits to operate at above a certain temperature. We'll talk about some of the issues, actually, when we talk about replacement cost. But in short, you have failures, different sorts of failure mechanisms. All of them get exponentially accelerated by temperature. So it's very important to maintain the temperature of your chip or computing platform within a certain limit. Of course, if it's something like a phone that you're putting to your skin, it's very obvious. It needs to be running cool, right? So that requires the use of appropriate packaging and cooling technology. And the cost of that packaging and cooling technology grows directly in proportion with power consumption, right? So that is how power can directly impact your system cost, which is the cost of selling your system to the user. It also affects the cost of operating these computing equipment. For example, a always-on personal computer, if you just leave it on all the time, you know, without the computer automatically going to sleep or standby mode, it's actually going to consume about $180 per year in terms of your utility bill. Okay. And then for data centers, this is about $4 to $8 per watt of load for data centers. Last but not least, there's the replacement cost. As I mentioned, the replacement cost is related to failure mechanisms, right? This may not be as much of an issue for consumer electronics because, you know, we tend to upgrade our phones or, you know, change our systems well before they fail. But certainly when you talk of infrastructure like servers or other computing equipment which have longer life cycles, you know, failure mechanisms are an important concern. One example of a failure mechanism is actually illustrated here. This is showing electromigration, which refers to the phenomenon of when you pass current at above certain densities through metal lines, the metal ions actually migrate. And, you know, in chips, we have these wires running parallel to each other, so you can actually have metal ions migrating, causing shorts between wires or causing wires to get cut. Okay. So you can have actual defects developed in chips if, because of electromigration in the wires. This is one example of a failure mechanism. There's many other failure mechanisms that are also triggered by temperature or temperature dependent. In general, a nice thumb of rule to go by is that the mean time to failure for a chip is half for every 10 degree centigrade increase in operating temperature. Okay, so if your chip is running 10 degrees hotter, you can expect half the lifetime, the mean time to failure. Okay, so that is, you know, in terms of how operation cost, product cost, operation cost, and replacement cost are impacted by power consumption. From a functional usage perspective, we as users, of course, always want anytime, anywhere for less. I've taken a cartoon, I borrowed a cartoon for this purpose from the cover of MIT's Technology Review magazine, which is actually showing different ways of how mobile phones are integrated into our lifestyles. And, you know, this was back in 2004. So many of these things, you know, may actually be taken for granted today. But, for example, using mobile phones as to pay for your subway fare, you know, it's something that is already possible today. Using mobile phones as ID, not quite yet, but clearly can happen soon. As cameras and video recording, well, we do it all the time. So the managing director of NTT Docomo, which is a leading mobile service provider in Japan, actually had this put it rather succinctly. By having your phone with you, you should not need anything else but your clothes. So roll in all the other functions, your wallet, your camera, your whatever else, your computer, roll everything in into the mobile phone. And, you know, we're not quite there yet, but we are well along the way to realizing this kind of a vision. Right? And in order to, as a result of the popularity of mobile devices, I mean, there's a, of course, a wide spectrum of mobile devices, all the way from, you know, really low-end, very small systems that go into smart cards, sensor nodes, medical implants on the one extreme, to, of course, laptops are also mobile devices. So this is a wide range of functionality, performance, and power consumption. But mobile devices or battery-powered devices account for a huge part of the semiconductor industry. Arguably, a lot of the growth happening in computing and semiconductor industry is actually driven by mobile devices, right? And if you look at the evolution in functionality and complexity illustrated with mobile phones, you know, this was actually the first, Motorola StarTAC was actually the first cell phone. It was this large, clunky, brick-sized thing that you needed to carry around with you. So it's amazing in terms of how these devices have not just evolved in terms of size, but also in terms of simultaneously in terms of increasing functionality, going from just purely for voice communication devices to, you know, adding personal organizer, instant messaging type functions to internet and multimedia devices to, you know, all sorts of other functions that we see today. Okay. Now, if you look at the energy consumption, so of course we want all of this, but we still want our mobile phone to at least last through the day, or if preferably for multiple days, and you'd like, you know, several days of standby time if possible, right? So if you look at, this is a study that we had done in my group back in the 2003-2004 timeframe, I believe, at NEC, where we actually looked at the different activities that a user might want to do in a typical day, in a 24-hour period, using their mobile phones, and projected, of course, you know, with time, what the demand for battery capacity would be on mobile phones. And we contrasted this with the actual availability of battery technology. And this is one of the major constraints, you know, when you have designed a mobile, any mobile device, is that you know that demand for computing capacity, power consumption, all of these grow much faster than one of the slowest time constraints involved in that industry is battery capacity. Battery capacity is, you know, maybe you'll be lucky if you see about 5% per year growth, right? So naturally, as you make these devices more complex and higher performance, their energy consumption grows, and that is disproportionate with battery capacity. Of course, there's been some disruptive technologies you know, at the time, this was again done back in 03, 04, fuel cells were on the, supposed to be on the horizon as a promising technology. They haven't quite materialized even yet, right? But even then, we were saying that even with projected disruptions in battery technology, there would still be a gap between the energy demand for these increasingly complex functions that mobile phones, in this case, would need to perform versus the battery capacity. And so here is a breakdown, for example, just showing that, you know, how much energy might be required per day and the kind of battery capacity you would need for that versus at the time, at least the available battery capacity was much smaller. Okay. And of course, battery capacities improve, but they're not quite improving at the rate you'd like to. So most mobile system designs eventually are battery limited, right? Okay, so that is, of course, one driver for power consumption. So if, you know, anything to do with if you're designing a chip that eventually is going to go into a battery-powered system, you are going to be very concerned about power. The other factor making power more important, and this is coming bottom-up from a technology perspective, is the end of classical scaling. Okay. Of course, we all know about, you know, scaling, Moore's law. This is the basis of the semiconductor industry. We've talked about it. I'm not going to repeat it. But classical scaling, it turns out, which was originally postulated by Dennard from IBM, you know, talks about, if you want to do classical scaling, all the device dimensions of the transistor, as well as the supply voltage, are all scaled equally by the same factor. So I won't, you know, so if you think of alpha as your scaling factor, you scale every technology generation, the supply voltage is reduced by that factor, the oxide thickness is scaled by that factor, the wire width, the gate width, everything is scaled by that factor. As a result, what ends up happening is if you do all the math and compute the power density, which is the amount of power consumed per unit area in integrated circuits, across technology generations, that remained constant as long as classical scaling was alive. Okay. So, you know, this has been talked about a lot in the industry, but, you know, sometime, you know, in the earlier part of the last decade, if you look at the industry, they actually moved away from classical scaling, right? As long as classical scaling was going on, you could get free improvements in performance with constant power density. You could get more transistors in the same unit area, but the power density would not change. Unfortunately, this, you know, ride was great while it lasted, but it could not continue forever. It had to end due to leakage, reliability concerns. You know, there's only so much you could scale the gate oxide to, for example, before reliability concerns set in. So because of constraints, primarily leakage and reliability, the notion of classical scaling was no longer feasible. We are continuing to scale, but not all device dimensions, you know, are scaling by the same value. And the supply voltage, in particular, the scaling of supply voltage has slowed down. As a result, what happens, ended up happening is this nice side benefit of classical scaling, which was that power density is constant, was lost. Okay. So what happened was, for some time, the industry continued, due to inertia, to still operate in the same mode they had been operating. Even though classical scaling died, they were continuing to pack more and more transistors, clock them at higher speeds, and all of that, okay? And what ended up happening, we all of course know this, is that the power density, illustrated here with Intel microprocessors, but the power density of chips increased to a point where things suddenly, it was clear that shortly it would become unsustainable, okay? And this led to a major shift in the computing industry, which of course we all now call multi-core, right? So around 2005, the first multi-core processors were released, and because of the fact that continuing along the frequency scaling path, or the way in which, you know, chips had been scaled, in spite of the end of classical scaling, was not sustainable. So the industry had to go down a different path where they said that, okay, we will not scale frequency. Instead, we will continue to try to integrate more transistors onto the chip, but we will use parallelism as the primary means to increase performance. And of course, we are now in the parallel era. It's not clear. There are many challenges in terms of how far it's going to last, but, you know, for better or worse, that's the path that the industry has had to take for lack of choice. So it was really all driven by power and power density. And what makes it really scary is, well, this is not the first time that the industry has faced such a inflection point. If you look at the origins of CMOS, if you look at, you know, computers that were prior to the CMOS era, built using bipolar technology, they also faced a similar increase in power density, which was unsustainable, and that was solved by the introduction of CMOS, which basically virtually at the time initially eliminated static power consumption. So all these technologies used before, bipolar technology, actually requires static power, right? You have constantly current flowing from VDD to ground all the time. Whereas, you know, CMOS gates, the great thing about them was that they consumed power only when they switched. There was no static power, and that led to this quantum reduction in the energy in power density, and that allowed the industry to continue again for some time, for a few decades. But now there is no such replacement for CMOS in sight. There's been a lot of research going in the device community to find the next switch, the next transistor. But certainly, I mean, there are some interesting directions from a research point of view that are emerging, but certainly far from viable from a commercial standpoint, right? So unlike the last time around, when CMOS was already a relatively proven technology and available to take over, at this point, there is no other technology that's going to come in and ride in and save the day. Okay. So this is a serious problem, and this is probably going to impact the computing industry much more than the previous transition, which, you know, we've managed to dodge a bullet there, but it's not going to be as easy this time around. Okay. So clearly, you know, there's multiple factors from a technology perspective. Also, power is going to, there is no easy solutions to be able to solve this power problem. Okay. Now let's focus a little bit on design, or let's wear the hat of chip designers and see how the lives of chip designers, IC designers, are impacted by power consumption. Well, power consumption, or the fact that the need to be able to account for power consumption, to be able to estimate the power consumption, to be able to reduce power consumption of chips, of course, is a new design task. We've talked about synthesizing circuits that are small, synthesizing circuits that are fast, but we also now need to synthesize, to be able to analyze the power consumption of a given circuit and to be able to synthesize circuits that are consuming lower power. We'll talk about some techniques to do that in starting off this lecture and the next lecture. But let's look at beyond just the need to analyze and reduce power consumption. How does power affect design complexity? One of these factors that comes in, especially when you actually look at what happens in IC design beyond logic synthesis. Once you have mapped your circuit into a particular technology library, you do place and route. You need to actually place these chips on your silicon substrate, connect the wires, route them up, and you also need to do supply of VDD and ground. The power consumption, the power lines, the power network that supplies the VDD and ground needs to be routed to each and every one of these chips, each and every one of these cells in your circuit. Now, if you look at the power network itself, it's a bunch of wires, but it has some finite impedance. So the current flowing through the power network will cause two things. First, the current flowing through power network is going to cause a certain voltage drop across the power network. So even though you apply a certain VDD at the pins of your chip, a gate embedded in the middle of your chip or a cell sitting in the middle of your chip will actually see a lower VDD, right? And that is due to the power drop in the network. There is resistive power drop, which is the so-called IR drop. And then there is the inductive power drop, which is the LDI by DT drop, which is also very important because when you have surges of power consumption in circuits, and typically when you have a clock edge, there's a lot of switching activity in these circuits at or around the clock edge, right? And that leads to an inductive noise, which also causes eventually voltage drop on the power in the power network. So both of these voltage drops will essentially result in the cells sitting in the middle of your chip, depending on how you're designing your power supply network, seeing a lower voltage. And you need to take that into account because these cells may be rated to operate at a certain voltage, right? Moreover, the current flowing through the power network may actually cause electromigration. Power network is one of the places where you typically see electromigration-related failures because those are the wires that in your chip that carry the maximum amount of current or have the maximum current density. So designing the power network such that you do not have premature failures due to electromigration is a major problem. So there are tools that really deal with how do you design the power network, how do you size these wires. Of course, you can say that I'll design my power network with huge wires, but you know, eventually the area penalty of that may not allow you to take, you know, to over-design. So you ideally you would like to not over-design too much, but still design with enough margin such that electromigration is not a problem in the power network. In order to do that, you need to be able to estimate how much current is going to be flowing through given a power network structure. Well, the current flowing through power network depends on how much power is consumed by the circuit. So you need to be able to analyze the power in the circuit and then feed it into these other tools that actually do power supply network design to be able to, you know, route these power and VDD and ground wires and size them appropriately. The other very related challenge is that the delay of, so we've talked about timing analysis. Now, we, during our entire discussion on timing analysis, we assumed that the delay of a gate was dependent perhaps on the input slew and the output load. But given the circuit, you could analyze the context in which this gate is being used and calculate the gate's delay. Now, that assumption is no longer true when you consider the fact that the delay of a gate or a cell actually depends on the voltage. Right? Delay is voltage dependent. Now, voltage itself depends on the IR drop or the LDI by DT drop through the power supply network, which in turn depends on the power consumption. So there is a cyclic dependency between timing and power. Timing, of course, impacts power because depending on the timing of the different gates, the temporal profile of when the gates are switching will change and the power consumption is going to change. But what we are talking about is that power impacts time because of the fact that power consumption is going to cause drops in your power supply network. And as shown here with the color plot, the chip or cells sitting in the cells or gates sitting in the middle of your chip may not see the same delay as the same supply voltage as cells sitting on the periphery. And therefore, in this case, you know, these cells are seeing a lower supply voltage and will be slower. So you need to actually perform IR drop analysis. And in order to do accurate timing analysis these days in commercial design flows, you actually need to perform IR drop analysis and feed that back into timing in order to redo the entire timing analysis, considering more accurate estimates of voltages, supply voltages that each of these cells will see. Okay. Here's an example for actually a not very recent technology, but, you know, for a 0.13 micron technology itself, the VDD supplied at the pins of the chip was 1.3 volts. That's the nominal VDD that you expect to see. The maximum IR drop in this case for this particular chip was about 264 millivolts. So it's a sizable percentage of the VDD itself. So this is not a negligible factor. You cannot just assume a worst case. You cannot, you know, if you assume a worst case, you'll be very pessimistic in timing across the entire chip. And again, you could also address this if your VDD drop is excessive. You can go back to power network design and say that I will, you know, maybe boost the sizes of the power supply network in certain places. I mean, you may want to add decoupling capacitors, which will essentially act as local energy stores and supply power when needed to prevent the droop in supply voltage at these certain parts of the chip, and so on and so forth. You can do various things to actually address this in order to improve the timing of your chip. Okay. So power and timing are very interdependent. So the message I'd like to leave you with here is that power, apart from the direct increase in design complexity, because you'd like to figure out how much power the chip is going to consume and to be able to reduce the power consumption, it impacts these other aspects, the reliability of chips, it impacts the timing of chips. There are these other dependencies that power consumption has, which increases the design complexity. So all these different tools in the design flow now need to be able to talk to each other. You cannot think of these as just separate things anymore. Okay, so that brings us to the end of the motivation for why power is important. Any questions thus far about what we've talked about? Okay, our focus here in this class is going to be, in this rest of this lecture and the next one, is going to be on how we can automatically estimate the power consumption at the logic level. That's question number one we'll try to understand. Given a gate-level circuit, how do you automatically analyze it, estimate its power consumption? Question number two is how do you automatically transform the circuit or synthesize it so as to reduce the power consumption. Yes?
Can you mention some of the cooling techniques that they have in place these days?
Well, it varies drastically based on the kind of computing system you're talking about and the range of power consumption or range of heat flux that you're trying to cool away. People have talked, of course, air cooling is the most common where you actually, you know, force air, you have a heat sink. Most computers these days have these heat sinks, which allow you, which are constructed of typically a material with very good thermal conductivity, some sort of a metal, where you actually, and the heat sink is designed so as to be able to maximally dissipate heat generated by the chip. These chips, you don't completely package the chip as used to be done when power densities were low enough. You would package the chip and then attach the heat sink onto the package. These days, the heat sink actually is much more integrated. So you actually take the silicon die and you add a material called the TIM, the thermal interface material, which is some sort of a gel, essentially forms an interface between the chip and the heatsink directly. Because packaging typically use ceramic or plastic in packaging, and they are not good conductors of heat. So the TIM is much better from that purpose. But on the other hand, you cannot take the metal heatsink and directly, you know, put it on the silicon, or, you know, try to attach it to the silicon die. There are other thermomechanical stress issues that arise. So you have this gel type material, which is the TIM, and you add the heat sink or attach the heat sink onto the TIM so that you have maximal thermal flow. This is pretty standard. This is what the state of the art technology. Certain high-end servers use liquid cooling. So where you actually have pipes with liquid that are actually flowing through rather than just air being forced through the heat sink or over the heat sink, you also have liquid cooling, where liquid is flowing in pipes through the heat sink, and that helps faster cooling. People are also talking about thermoelectric devices these days, to actually, you know, use thermoelectric devices as heat pumps. So these are now active devices where you actually use these thermoelectric devices to pull the heat away from hotspots to do localized cooling. These are not quite commercial yet, but, you know, there's a lot of interest even in the industry to investigate these sorts of solutions. So that's a completely different direction. But unfortunately, there is, you know, all of these come with a cost, whether it's liquid cooling or any of these other more fancy cooling technologies. You can address the problem by cooling, but that, you know, there's only so much you can do there, and the cost you incur in doing that also is quite high. Right. So our focus now is, you know, in the context of logic design, in the context of the technologies we've talked about in this course, how can we address the power problem? How do you estimate power consumption given a circuit represented at the gate level? How do you reduce its power consumption? So for today, we'll talk a little bit about power dissipation in CMOS circuits. To be able to estimate power consumption, we first need to understand the power mechanisms. So a little bit of quick background about power dissipation in CMOS circuits, and we'll talk about a little bit about the power analysis problem. Given a circuit, how do you estimate how much power it's going to consume? Okay. It turns out that power consumption is, a little more complex than timing in some ways, in that, you know, power consumption in a gate, in a single gate, depends on the switching activity and the values of the inputs to the gate, right? It depends on state, it depends on switching activity. So in order to be able to estimate power consumption, you therefore need to be able to estimate the value probabilities at the different signals in the circuit and the switching activities at the different signals in the circuit. And that is relevant when you're talking about estimating the average power consumption. You might also, for thermal reasons, you may also want to be able to specify the worst case power consumption of a circuit, in which case it's a different kind of a problem. It becomes a search problem. You need to find a vector or sequence of vectors that maximizes the power consumption of the circuit, right? So these are, you know, the complexities in power estimation. But before we talk about that, we'll initially talk about, like we talked about timing models for gates, we'll talk about how you can, given a gate, how you can model its power consumption to different levels of detail, varying levels of accuracy. So basics of CMOS power consumption. There is three major components of power consumption in CMOS circuits: capacitive switching power, short circuit power, and leakage power. The capacitive switching and short circuit power together are sometimes referred to as dynamic power. In contrast, leakage is referred to as static power consumption, because when you don't have any switching activity, the first two components relate to when you have switching at the outputs of gates. The output value of some gate output in the circuit has to change in order to incur capacitive switching power or short circuit power. On the other hand, leakage power is incurred even when you have no switching activity. Okay. Therefore, it's referred to as static power. In technology nodes which were greater than 90 nanometer, older technologies, dynamic power dominated. Static power was, you know, under 10%. Leakage has become, unfortunately, an equal culprit in nanoscale CMOS technologies. It's something that, you know, will continue to be a concern as we scale. Of course, there's various sorts of device and material innovations that have gone into keeping leakage under control. But in spite of that, it is a fact that leakage has become a first-order contributor. You cannot ignore leakage anymore in modern technologies. So the capacitive power is basically refers to the power required to charge and discharge capacitances. What capacitance are we talking about? Well, these are parasitic capacitances that are inherently associated with the transistors themselves, the devices. They are also capacitances associated with the wires that connect the gates or connect the transistors to each other. So all of them essentially represent capacitance that when the output of a gate needs to transition, it needs to either charge or discharge that capacitance. Okay. So as shown as an example here for a CMOS inverter, one way of thinking of the capacitive parasitics associated with the inverter and the wires it drives is as a lumped capacitance sitting at this gate output that this gate needs to charge or discharge. Okay, so if you have a transition, you know, when you have a falling transition at the input of the inverter, the output needs to rise, and therefore this capacitor actually needs to be charged. It was initially discharged and needs to be charged. And correspondingly, when the output needs to fall, this capacitor needs to be discharged. So essentially what happens is when you have a falling transition, the first transition in the input, the PMOS network is conducting, and you have the charging current flowing through the PMOS network and actually charging this capacitor. And when you discharge, the current in the capacitor is discharged through the NMOS network. So you have this little loop here which causes discharging current. Now, even though, you know, the charging and discharging happens to the capacitors, because of the fact that you have finite resistance in all of these charging and discharging paths, the current flow for charging and discharging causes power to be dissipated in those resistances, which gets turned into heat. Okay? Because if you look at it, you know, if you just had capacitance and no resistance, you know, you would not be dissipating power. You'd be charging and discharging, but the power actually gets dissipated in the resistance. But interestingly enough, if you calculate, go through the process of trying to come up with a formula for the power consumption, it only depends on the value of the capacitance, right? Because you know how much energy is being put in to charge this capacitor, and you know all of that is going to be eventually dissipated when you discharge it. So the energy required to charge this load capacitance is the charge, it's Q times V, which is nothing but Q itself is, as we know, C times V. So this is nothing but CV square. Okay. Power, as we know, is energy per transition. So this is the energy required to charge the load capacitance. And this energy gets dissipated when you discharge it. So this, the power consumption is energy per transition times the rate of transitions, because power is energy per unit time, right? And this is energy per transition into how often you have these transitions. So it's CL times VDD square times the rate at which the frequency of 0 to 1 transitions. But on average, if you take any node in the circuit, the rate of 0 to 1 and 1 to 0 transitions over a long period of time, over a large number of transitions, should be roughly the same. You might have one more transition of one type than the other, but over a large number of transitions, they are the same. So this can also be represented or simplified as CL times VDD square times the frequency, the clock frequency here of the circuit, times the probability that you'll have a 0 to 1 transition in any given clock period. Right? So that is the capacitor switching power, the formula for capacitor switching power. Over time, as I mentioned, any signal in the circuit has a roughly equal probability of 0 to 1 and 1 to 0. So you can rewrite capacitor switching power. This is often the formula you'll see in textbooks as half CV square times N times F. The half comes in because now N is the total number of transitions, either 0 to 1 or 1 to 0. And, you know, if you only want to count charging transitions, they are roughly half the total number of transitions. Okay. So half CV square times N. N is the number of transitions, 0 to 1 or 1 to 0, cumulative number of transitions per clock cycle, and F is the clock frequency. Okay. N is sometimes also referred to as the switching activity, the per clock cycle expected switching activity at that signal. Okay. So this is what capacitive power, this is how you compute capacitive power at the level for single gate. Now, in order to compute the capacitive power, of course, you need to know each of these terms. You need to know what CL is. Well, that is typically a physical design problem. So at the logic level, your standard cell library will have certain values of loads. This gate is going to be driving some other gates. So you have a certain value of load that the other gates will present to this gate, and that will add to CL. But you also need to be able to estimate the wire length between the gates in order to estimate the wire capacitance and add that to the load capacitance as well, right? At the logic level, you can use wire load models, or you can actually do a full place and route. And once you know the actual dimensions of the wires, you can do a parasitic extraction. In other words, you know, for a wire of a given width and length, you can actually extract its capacitance and then feed those capacitances, back annotate those capacitances onto your gate level circuit, and then do a more accurate analysis with more accurate values of CL. Okay. So CL, you know, you get from the standard cell library, and wire load models are actually back annotation after layout. VDD, of course, you know VDD. If you want to be a little more accurate, you also account for the fact that different gates have different VDDs. So you need to do, but that's a chicken and egg problem, right? To calculate that, you need to do power analysis in the first place to calculate the VDD of different embedded gates in the design. So you could do that iteratively, but in practice, mostly you assume for the purpose of power analysis, initially you just assume the nominal VDD, which is a conservative assumption because VDD actually will be lower than that, times the switching activity. So this is the primary challenge which you need to address at the gate level. How do you estimate the switching activity? Given a circuit consisting of a network of gates or a sequential circuit in general, how do you estimate the switching activity at any given signal in the circuit? F is, of course, the clock period. So that is the clock period at which you're clocking the circuit, or clock frequency at which you're clocking the circuit. Okay. So capacitive, so the term, so we will talk a little bit about in our subsequent discussion about how you estimate N, because that is the main challenge, that needs to be addressed by a power analysis tool at the gate level. The term CL times N times F is often also referred to as a switch capacitance. This is the total amount of capacitance you're charging and discharging as you're operating the circuit. The other major component of power, as we saw, is leakage power. Leakage power itself is further composed of three major components. The so-called sub-threshold leakage power, this deals with the fact that a transistor, we like to think of it as a perfect switch. In other words, when it's off, it has an infinite resistance, and when it's on, it has a zero resistance. But in reality, that's not true. You have a finite on resistance and a finite off resistance, and therefore, even when the transistor is in the off state, there is going to be some current flowing through it. Okay, that's the sub-threshold leakage, which is flowing through a transistor that is supposed to be turned off. You have the gate leakage, the fact that the insulator separating the gate from the transistor channel itself is not a perfect insulator, so it has some tunneling current, there's some current that's going to be going through that gate, especially when you have gate oxides which are only a few atomic layers thick. This becomes more and more of a concern. So that is the gate leakage, the leakage that actually tunnels through from the gate to the channel. And then you have all of these, you have what is known as the band-to-band tunneling or the reverse biased junction leakage, which is, if you think of the device picture of a transistor, you have all these reverse biased diodes or junctions that are formed between the source and drain and the substrate, and that is something that you there is some amount of leakage that is flowing through those reverse biased diodes there, and that is referred to as the band-to-band tunneling leakage. So these are the three components of leakage. Traditionally, sub-threshold leakage was supposed to be the dominant, but more recently, gate leakage so also is significant. So these are the two major components of leakage in current technologies. So in order to be able to estimate the power consumption of a circuit, just like, you know, when we did timing analysis, we started off by talking about how do you model the timing of a single gate. Similarly, we need to answer the question, how do you model the power consumption of a single gate, right? And there is various power models you can use for gates. For dynamic power consumption, the simplest power model is the unit capacitance model, followed by the lumped output capacitance, the pin-based model, transition-based, and state-dependent model. For leakage power, similarly, you have constant leakage model or an input-dependent leakage model. So there is different levels of accuracy and complexity of the models that you have a choice between. And depending on which stage of logic synthesis you are in, for example, in technology-independent optimizations, you probably will be using a more simpler model because you don't have any way accurate information about what cell each node in the Boolean network is going to be implemented using. But maybe during technology mapping, you can use, or post-technology mapping, you can use a more accurate power model. Okay. So in the unit capacitance model, which is the simplest model, you just assume that all gates have equal load capacitance. And the reason, and this is a technology-independent model, clearly, and what this does is that it allows you to express the dynamic power, switch capacitance power of the gate as just proportional to the total number of, the total switching activity of all the gates. Because the capacitive load capacitance factor, you know, is equal, so you can pull it out of the summation. Normally, you would say I need to sum up the power consumption of all the gates, so I'll need to do the sigma of half CV square times N times F for each gate, right? If, since you're assuming that, you know, of course, V square is constant, you pull V square out of the term, you assume that F, of course, is constant, that's the clock period of the entire circuit, you pull that out of the summation. The load capacitance here also is pulled out of the summation because you're assuming that it's a unit load capacitance model. So the only thing that is in the summation is the switching activity. Okay. You can extend this a little bit and say that, you know, this is not quite accurate. If I have a gate that is fanning out to, you know, 10 different places, it should be driving a larger capacitance, and you can add a per fan out you know, you can say that there's a base capacitance plus so much per fan out. And that is sort of like the load dependent delay model. You said there's a base delay of the gate, intrinsic delay plus a certain load dependent delay. Okay. Similarly, you can do the same thing for, capacitance and therefore dynamic switch capacitance power as well. The second level of detail in modeling is to compute a lumped output capacitance. Again, this can be computed based on the technology library, and you can of course add the inherent gate capacitances of the cells that you're driving to the estimated wire capacitance, which is either going to be from a wire load model or a more detailed back annotation from layout. Okay. And then you can also go to a pin-based model where you say that, you know, each of these input and output, each pin of the cell, each input and output of the cell has a different capacitance associated with it. Okay. And so you have these, each of these capacitances, and they appropriately, you know, get charged or discharged based on which cell is driving these capacitances. And you count the effective load capacitance of each gate based on the actual input capacitances of the gates that it is driving. Okay. So clearly you can see some sort of trend in terms of increasing accuracy as you go from top to bottom. You can also look at a transition-based model, where what you do is basically you specify the power consumption for each possible transition at the gate inputs. So rather than specifying capacitance, you say that, let's say I have a lower level or transistor level implementation of this gate, and I'll, let's say, do a spice simulation of that implementation, for different possible input waveforms corresponding to different transitions at the input values. And for each transition, I'll actually, using the lower level circuit simulator, I'll estimate how much power is being consumed, and I will use that as the power consumption for each gate. So here, for example, you enumerate all possible transitions consisting of previous vector and current vector, and using a lower level circuit simulator, you can actually calculate the energy consumption, in this case strictly not the power, because to calculate power, you need to divide by the actual clock period of the entire circuit in which it is used. So what you actually calculate here, it should be energy. Now, this table, of course, is exponential in the number of gate inputs, right? So you have 2 power n possible current inputs and 2 power n possible next inputs in this pair. So, and you need to basically simulate for 2 power 2 n cases. But the assumption is that since cells are not likely to be large, n is going to be small, so it's okay to do this. So this is something that is actually used quite commonly in practice, but this still assumes something. It assumes that the transitions on the different inputs are either simultaneous or separated by sufficient time that they do not interact with each other. What do I mean by that? What I mean is that, you know, over time, you can have transitions at the inputs to the gate arrive at different times, points in time. They may not all arrive at the same time. So in this case, when we model, let's say, a 1-1 to 0-0, if you look at this transition, you have two inputs transitioning. You will, when you simulate, you need to provide, at the circuit level, you need to provide this input vector pair as a waveform. You need to make a certain assumption about the timing of these two, the 1 to 0 on the first input and 1 to 0 on the second input. You need to assume something about the timing of those two transitions. And, you know, for lack of any better knowledge, what you assume in this case is that those two transitions are perfectly arriving at the same time, right? And do circuit simulation. On the other hand, if you have multiple transitions, you can always have multiple transitions at a gate, even within a single clock cycle. That's glitching. Then you assume that you add up the power consumption. Let's say, you know, you have a transition at the inputs of a gate from 1-1 to 0-0, and then eventually the input finally changes from 0-0 to 0-1. So what you can do if you have this kind of a model is you can take the energy consumed by the gate, dissipated by the gate for the 1-1 to 0-0 transition, and add to that the energy dissipated in the 0-0 to 1-1 transition. And that additive assumption essentially assumes that these two transitions are sufficiently separated in time that they do not interact. In reality, if you had the 1-1 to 0-0 immediately followed by the 0-0 to 0-1, right, then those two transitions will actually interact. And the energy consumption is not necessarily going to be the sum of these two values. But this model assumes that you can, you know, it's completely black or completely white. Either transitions are exactly happening at the same time when multiple inputs to a gate transition, or they are sufficiently separated that you can treat them as two different transitions and just add up the corresponding energy consumptions for the two different transitions. Okay. So that is an approximation in this model. So it still is not totally accurate, but, you know, at the gate level, it is considered to be accurate enough, typically. You could also go one step further and have a state-dependent power model. So this accurately accounts for the effect of the history of inputs that you apply on the gate to the internal signals within a gate. As we discussed in the context of timing, you know, those internal nodes inside the gate may be charged or discharged based on the history of input vectors that the gate has seen. Now, when you charge or discharge an internal node, that of course also impacts power consumption. So you could have a state-dependent model where, even though this is actually a combinational circuit, functionally, you, from a power consumption point of view, you actually think of it as a state transition diagram where you have the state of the inputs and the outputs forming this three tuple of bits. And you say that, you know, for each of the edges in this FSM, which corresponds to a transition, you will associate a certain power consumption with it. Okay. This typically requires a very accurate circuit simulator. Of course, you know, something like SPICE to build this model. This is usually overkill. For most, at least currently, most commercial design flows do not really, you know, consider the history effect on power consumption of gates. The transition-based model, which we talked about in the previous slide, is the most predominantly used one in practice. So that's as far as dynamic power goes. You also need to model the leakage power, since it's becoming more and more important in current technologies. The simplest model for leakage power is constant. When I say constant, what I really mean is it really depends on the gate type and the total amount of transistor width. Because leakage, to a first order, depends on the, you know, total amount of, you know, the total number of transistors, the cumulative width of all the transistors that are leaking. Okay. So, given a cell in the library, to a first order, you can calculate its leakage based on the cell type. That is, you know, the actual internal implementation of the cell and the actual sizes of the transistors. You can go one level beyond that and have a more accurate model where you recognize that leakage is actually input dependent. Okay. So you can actually have the lookup table based on the input values seen by the gate and say that for different inputs, the gate has different leakage power consumption. And this, it turns out, is actually fairly important in practice because of the, you know, so-called stacking effect, which says that if you have two transistors which are supposed to be turned off, which are actually in series, two transistors in series turned off, that has a huge positive impact on reducing the leakage of the gate, right? So, you know, it's not like, you know, if you think of it purely from a resistance point of view, the resistance of the two transistors is going to add up, leakage is going to be half. But in reality, it's much, much less than half. Okay. Stacking two or three gates and transistors in series that are turned off virtually eliminates leakage. And in fact, that is the motivation for the well-known supply gating or power gating technique, where if you have idle blocks and chips, what you do is you add these additional sleep transistors. So if you have a logic block which is being supplied by VDD and ground, what you can do is you can add this additional transistor, which is known as a supply gating transistor. So you have various gates. This can be actually a sea of gates, right? And eventually you have some ground line that is going and feeding all of these gates. Of course, you need to do this at the right granularity. You cannot do it with a very large circuit block or a very small circuit block. You need to do this at the right granularity. But what you do is, if you know whenever this circuit is idle, you can essentially turn off this transistor and thereby drastically reduce all the leakage. Because this transistor now appears in series to the pull down networks of each and every gate inside this block of logic. So, and this technique is actually, you know, very commonly used in designs today to reduce leakage power consumption. Okay. So, but when you're modeling, you need to account. So this is the main reason, the stacking effect is the main reason why you need to account for the input dependence of leakage power consumption. Okay. So, yeah, as I said, this considers the stacking effect and the loading effect. For power estimation, what else do you need to know? So you have these power models for the individual gates. As we saw, you need to know the value probabilities and the switching activities at all the signals in the circuit. To calculate dynamic power, you need to know the switching activities at the different signals in the circuit. To calculate static power, you need to know the value probabilities, because only when you know the value probabilities, you can figure out how often each of these input combinations to the gate occurs, and therefore you can calculate the average leakage power in the gate. This, of course, depends on whether you're trying to compute the average power consumption or the worst-case power consumption of the circuit. Here, the discussion we are going to go through for now is going to focus on the average power consumption of the circuit. Okay. So for average power consumption, you need to know when I say average, I mean average over, you know, a large number of input vectors, or average, you know, over time, as the circuit sees different inputs or input vectors, it will consume different power, of course, at each instant in time, but you're averaging it out over time. So for that, you need to know value properties and switching activities. So in general, you have a circuit with primary inputs and primary outputs. You have a gate sitting somewhere in the circuit, which has inputs xi, yi, and outputs zi. You know that the power consumption of the circuit is the summation of the dynamic power consumption plus leakage power consumption of each gate, sum it up over all gates in the circuit. And the dynamic power consumption is a function of the number of transitions at each of these pins of that gate, the inputs and the outputs of the gate. The leakage power consumption is really a function of the seeing different values at the inputs of the gate, right? Because you know that, for example, you know, if probability of xi, yi being 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, each of these cases will have a different leakage. And if you know the probabilities, you can average them, do a weighted sum to calculate the leakage of the gate. And you sum the dynamic and leakage power over all gates in the circuit to get the total power consumption, average power consumption of the circuit. If you assume this problem of calculating the average switching activities and the value probabilities is actually it's a complex problem because of the fact that signals in the circuit may actually transition multiple times before in a single clock cycle before they settle down to the final value, right? If you assume zero delay, and what zero delay does for you is it essentially says that all gates in the circuit evaluate instantaneously. Therefore, you will not have any glitches. You will not have any intermediate transitions. The previous cycle's steady state value will immediately transition to the next cycle's steady state value. Under zero gate delays, each gate output can switch at most once in each clock cycle. And whether there is a transition or not just depends purely on the current and previous input vectors. So in this kind of a scenario, for example, if you have a simple example, you have the input of gate G1, inputs of gate G1 being constant 0 and constant 1, and you have a rising transition on the third input of the circuit, you know that the output of gate G1 is going to be constant 0. It's not going to transition in this clock cycle, but the output of the OR gate is going to transition. So you can calculate the number of transitions or the switching activity for this pair of input vectors for each of the gates. N1 is for gate G1, N2 is for gate G2. Now, similarly, you have a different pair of input vectors. Similarly, you can calculate the number of transitions for this pair of vectors here. So initially here, N1 is 0 and N2 is 1. Here, N1 is 1, N2 is also 1. And you do this for all possible input vector pairs and calculate the average, because you don't know what specific input vector pair is actually going to be seen in practice. If you know something more about the nature of the inputs that the circuit receives, you can try to use that information to bias the kind of vectors for which you actually calculate the power consumption or the switching activity, and thereby, you know, tune your power estimate to be more relevant to that particular type of input, right? But in general, so you can envision, of course, one way of doing this is by exhaustive simulation. You can apply all possible input vectors to the circuit, simulate it, calculate the switching activities, and then take the average. The problem is that number is too large, right? For large circuits, this number is very large, and you need to do this often in the context of a sequential circuit. You cannot assume that the inputs of the combinational logic have random values. The values at those signals actually depends on what the circuit has computed in the previous cycle. So there is that temporal correlation that you need to factor into account. But in the general case, meaning that when you do not have zero delays for gates, it becomes a more complex problem because of what is known as glitching. Output of each gate may actually switch multiple times for a single input vector pair before settling to the final value. For example, if you have a rising transition and a falling transition, the same circuit as before, when you have multiple transitions in this case, you actually have a glitch at the output where the output falls at t equals 1 and then again rises at t equals 2. Here's another example. You can actually have more glitches depending on the number of levels of logic in the circuit and the timing of the different transitions. You can actually have, you know, each signal glitching several times before it settles. In this case, if you think of it from a zero delay perspective, the output has zero transitions because the initial value is zero, final value is zero, but in reality it has four transitions due to glitching. Skipping through the animation here. And here's an example of glitching in a real circuit, if you have a 16-bit ripple carry adder and you apply a 0 to 1 transition at the carry in, and you actually had one of these inputs to be constant 0 while the other input also had a rising transition, the sum bits, if you think about it, initially the sum bits are supposed to be 0 because sum is nothing but the XOR of the carry in, XOR AI, XOR BI, right? So if you look at it, initially the sum is 0 and even finally the sum is going to be 0 because both Cin and one of the inputs have both transitioned to 1. So when you have an even number of 1s for an XOR gate, the output is still 0. So your initial value of all the sum bits is supposed to be 0. The final value of all the sum bits is supposed to be 0. But if you simulate a circuit like this with SPICE, this is actually a result of a circuit level simulation of a 16-bit ripple carry adder. If you look at the waveforms at each of the sum bits, even though they're not supposed to have any transitions eventually, you see the glitches at each of them. So what happens is that depending on the time separation between the two rising transitions at the carry in and the sum, remember that the inputs always, let's assume in this case, arrive at t equals 0, carry in arrives at t equals 0. So all the inputs to the entire adder transition at this time. However, if you look at the adder slices, which are as you go from LSB to MSB, their carry in arrives later and later, right? So this is actually a example of a vector pair that propagates, that triggers this carry propagation. So what happens is that for any of these full adder slices, what ends up happening is that the timing separation, the relative timing of the arrival of this input transition on the AI input and the carry in input is different. As a result, you have glitches of different height. So this is actually the output voltage at each of the sum bits. So you'll see in some cases, you have only a partial glitch, right? So for bit one, you have this little glitch, where you have a little blip in the voltage and it immediately gets suppressed. And that's because of the fact that the input transition, these two input transitions are very close to each other. Okay. On the other hand, in the case of S2, the input transitions, because of the fact that the carry in is slightly more delayed, the input transitions for this particular full adder slice are slightly more separated in time. The input AI arrives initially, whereas the carry in arrives a little later. So what you see is that the glitch is a little higher. And eventually, when you go to S15, you have a full blown glitch where you have the value reaches the maximum value and goes back down. Right? So essentially, this is an example that illustrates glitching in data path circuits. Glitching actually can be quite common. Multipliers are known to be notorious for glitching. About 1/4 to 1/3 of the power consumption in the multiplier is actually due to glitching. So if you do zero delay based estimates of switching activity, even though it's computationally easier to do, you will be underestimating power consumption, considering glitching is important. This is probably where we can stop for today. And in the next lecture, we'll talk about how we can automatically perform power estimation by automatically calculating, given a logic circuit, calculating the switching probabilities of the different signals in the circuit. And we'll also talk a little bit about how power reduction techniques are fit in the context of the logic level synthesis flow that we've already described.